cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine.
Plus global business, finance, and tech news.
The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
Last week, you know, the House of Representatives here in the United States passing a bipartisan bill that would effectively ban TikTok from the U.S. unless its Chinese parent company ByteDance divests the app. The measure now moves to the Senate. President Biden, who has previously blocked TikTok, from government devices and tightened restrictions on data sharing, says he will sign it if it ultimately passes.
Okay, yet, Carol, a TikTok, you know, ban may not be enough. So notes a story featured in the new issue of Business Week magazine, which is available on newsstands on the Bloomberg Terminal and at Bloomberg.com/Businessweek. This story by Anna Edgerton, Bloomberg News Seattle Bureau Chief, and Alex Branca, Bloomberg News Technology Reporter. Anna joining us from Seattle. Alex from our Los Angeles Bureau. And I do want to start with you and just take a step back here before we get going on the intricacies of privacy and what these privacy advocates are saying. Just give us the latest on a potential TikTok ban or divestment. What is the most recent news?
Yeah, so what we did with this story was we wanted to look at where the opposition is unified. You know, the opposition to this bill is unified. So this bill passed overwhelmingly in the House. There's a lot of bipartisan support for it. But about, I think it was 62 members from both Republicans and Democrats voted against it. And almost all of them said the way to safeguard U.S. user data is not by banning one company or even forcing its parent company to sell. The way to protect U.S. user data is to pass a federal data privacy standard that applies to all companies. So, you know, China can still have access to to U.S. user data buying it from data brokers, you know, that got it from Facebook. So there are other ways for Chinese authorities to get this information that's not TikTok. And so just banning this one company is not going to solve the problem. And that's where we see, you know, a lot of the opposition in the House and also some of that starting to bubble up in the Senate. And that's where this is really going to be important, is to see how senators line up either in support of this measure or wanting to take a different approach.
And don't tell me, Anna, but your dog is a TikTok star, but we'll maybe talk about that later.
Has the potential.
Has the potential, don't we all? Alex, come on in on this. You understand the tech community, you're out there on the West Coast, but you've been reporting on the sector for a long time. Is there rumblings that they're nervous and concerned that there could be more regulatory oversight? Or they're like, yeah, we've heard this before? Because it is kind of staggering, right, that there is a lot of freedom still in the social media space when it comes to oversight.
We have certainly heard concerns about data privacy before. We have certainly seen transgressions by the likes of Meta when it was called Facebook, by other companies. The CEOs have been trotted down to DC to have these conversations. What we haven't seen is any kind of legislation that overarches the entire industry in the same way that this TikTok bill does for the ByteDance-owned social media app. Now, look, a lot of the executives from TikTok's rivals have largely said, we would love to see federal privacy privacy regulation, because currently there's a patchwork of laws in different states. So give us the rules and we'll follow them. That being said, Carol, we've also seen them fight every bill and, and legislation in different legal venues that wouldn't necessarily be an easy path. So while we did have reporting of Meta in the past kind of lobbying against TikTok in past years, we haven't heard a lot of that just yet. That doesn't mean it's not happening, but certainly the companies like Meta or Alphabet's YouTube would stand to benefit if TikTok were to snap disappear because of this legislation.
So Anna, come on.
However,
back.
If I could jump
go
in
ahead,
there,
please.
Alex is absolutely right, but I think there is also concern from these companies that what the U.S. does in forcing ByteDance to sell TikTok could set a really bad precedent for, you know, the operations of Meta abroad. So I think while they would not mind TikTok or disappearing, there is a lot of concern about the government forcing that to happen.
Well, I want to Anna, for you to, for a moment, talk a little bit about what these privacy advocates would actually like to see here. Because yes, these companies say they, you know, quote unquote, want regulation. But we've seen, as Alex mentioned, what they've done in the past when the bills are up. What do these companies, or what do these critics say the regulation should exist for these companies? Like, what would that look like?
So the best example to look at is a bill that was passed by the House Energy and Commerce Committee last year. It was, I think, the ADPPA, the American Data Privacy Protection Act. And that has kind of the like agreed upon tenets of data privacy. Now, a lot of these are similar to the GDPR in Europe. They're similar to the standards that some of the states have set. But the most important thing for tech companies is that it preempts all of the state standards. So that way they would have one standard that they would have to comply with in the US. There's also a question about how it would be enforced, whether it'd be up to the attorney general or whether there would be a private right of action where individuals could sue these tech companies. But the most important elements are having the option to delete your data, having the option to withdraw consent for it being collected, knowing to whom it's being sold. So a lot of this is about giving users in the US more control over what happens to their data in just the normal kind of interactions of existing online, well, as so much of our life is these days.
This is where we've got to jump in. And I'm curious, because we are certainly hearing the drumbeat for that, for individuals like you, me, Tim, for us to have more control on our data. Having said that, I'm looking at this 1965 U.S. Supreme Court case that unanimously struck down rules for the U.S. Post Office to restrict the spread of communist propaganda from the Chinese Communist Party. So, I mean, I know there's national security concerns about TikTok, but there's also concerns about all of our data and how it's being used. Alex, if that didn't happen, what hope is there for lawmakers to come together and say, it's time to really rein in these social media companies? We've already seen the implications politically and on individuals, the negative implications. That's not critics saying it. It's just a reality. So how likely is it that something really comes down hard regulatory on the social media universe?
What I'm hearing from experts, particularly in the privacy space, is they are looking at this moment and saying, look, there's a lot of energy. People are really energized behind the idea of reigning in TikTok. Maybe we can expand the scope. As to whether or not that would happen, look, this TikTok bill has kind of gone the furthest that any of these bills have ever gone in getting and passing a vote in one of the chambers. So in terms of actual, you know, federal privacy regulation, this moment seems to be one. That is why we see the opposition to this bill potentially circling around this idea, because there's a lot of energy here. But I was in the room for hearings about child safety and child data privacy. I was in the room for hearings with TikTok CEO where they were talking about kind of broader data privacy issues. And we've also had some legislation that's been introduced around data brokers, those third parties who vacuum up information on the internet and sell it for a price to kind of whoever would want it, for an adversary or otherwise. So we've heard about this. The social media era is almost, what, a decade old?
Yeah.
And this is kind of the furthest legislation we've seen. So I'd be hard-pressed to put a percentage on it yet, Carol.
Yeah.
But we'll certainly be like, keeping an ear to the Senate to see what happens.
Well, you both have great perspectives on this. You both are now on the West Coast. But Anna, you used to be certainly covering D.C. and understood politics in a big, big way. I mean, I do wonder, as we all watched TikTok last week, how much of it was politics versus real kind of needs and want to change policy. So politics versus policy. How do you kind of game it out, Anna?
Yeah, there's a lot of that going on. I mean, when this first kind of it appeared to come out of nowhere, you know, Alex and I were following this really closely last year, and then it kind of got overtaken by AI. And it was really hard to find someone on the Hill who wanted to talk about TikTok, you know, summer of last year. When this came back up, my first thought was, well, House Republicans want to make this awkward for Biden because he just started a TikTok account for his campaign. And I think that is part of it. And, you know, trying to create this hypocrisy for Biden and saying it's a national security threat, but I'm going to use it to reach young voters. However, I think there are a lot of people on Capitol Hill who are genuinely concerned about Chinese ownership of this really powerful app. You know, this is not, you know, while Facebook is perhaps is still the biggest, you know, has the most users, you know, other apps have their kind of niche uses. There are 170 million Americans that spend hours on TikTok every day and have a very kind of emotional connection to the app. And, you know, Alex can talk more about that. But the concern, you know, that we hear over and over again about national security is that the Chinese Communist Party can get access to U.S. user data and also like kind of the aggregate level of like patterns of U.S. behavior. Right. And also that they could put a thumb on the algorithm to show not necessarily like communist propaganda, but harmful content to U.S. users.
Hey, guys, we're going to have to run. We know this conversation that will continue again in the future. Anna Edgerton and Alex Barinka, both of Bloomberg News, joining us with what's next maybe for social media.
When cyber criminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. Finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day. Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do. The people in the spotlight, athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers, they're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern. Listen on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
We did also get some economic news this morning. New U.S. home construction bouncing back sharply last month from weather-related weakness at the start of the year. This is builders benefit from slightly more favorable mortgage rates and a dearth of existing houses for sale, Tim.
Yeah, building permits, a proxy for future construction, they did rise to a rate that's the fastest since August. Both permits and starts figures for January were also revised higher. And yet for investors, the focus is all about tomorrow's FOMC meeting, which, of course, kicked off this morning.
All right, everybody. With a preview, what to watch out for. Back with us is Dr. Steve Skanke, Chief Economic Advisor over at Keel Point. He's a former U.S. Treasury and White House National Security Council staff member. And then right here in studio, we've got Bloomberg Economics U.S. Economist Stuart Paul. Steve is in Palm Beach, Florida. Stuart, as I said, right here in studio. Stuart, I want to start with you. First up, remind us of what the data backdrop is that Fed Chair and the FOMC members will be reviewing today and tomorrow ahead of that decision.
The thing that's going to be most pressing and that's going to be most front of mind for them is just the hot inflation prints that we've seen so far this year. That's, of course, number one. Other side of their mandate is focusing on employment. And again, we've seen hot non-farm payroll prints so far to start the year. The household survey has been a little bit weaker. We've seen an uptick in the unemployment rate. But if we're seeing the pace of hiring that we've seen, over 200,000 jobs a month to start the year, plus hot inflation, they're going to feel comfortable keeping their foot on the brakes and messaging relatively hawkishly, perhaps,
in
their
statement. Gives them some
room, right here? That's right.
Okay, Stuart, so what does it all mean for the summary of economic projections, the dot plot? What are you and the folks over at Bloomberg Economics thinking in terms of the median rate that the Fed participants are expecting?
We're still expecting to see them showing 75 basis points of cuts this year. And that's really weighing the two things. We've had hot inflation, so in their summary of economic projections, we're going to expect to see an upward revision of their core inflation forecast for 2024, up to maybe 2.5% from 2.4%. Not huge, but taking into account the printed inflation that we've seen. And then we could also see an upward revision of their unemployment forecast, again, because we've seen the uptick already.
And they're going to say 2% is never going to happen. No, I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. All right, Steve, come on in on this conversation. What are you expecting from the Fed and why?
Well, I think as Stuart says, they're not going to give any guidance one way or the other about what they're going to do with interest rates. Jerome Powell was probably most forthcoming when he did his semiannual congressional testimony a couple of weeks ago. In which he said that, when they get the confidence, and he added, and we are not far from it, it'll be appropriate to dial back the level of restrictions so that we don't drive the economy into recession. So I think the real pivot point is at what point do they have, what's the balance between believing that the economy is not close to tipping into recession and also that inflation is not ticking back up. When we look at the numbers, when we were on at the end of January, the core personal consumption expenditures inflation metric was annualizing at 1.9%, below their 2% target. Now after January, it was up to 2.4% and just based on a construction of what it would be like based on what we've seen with the CPI and PPI data, it'll probably be 2.9% annualized over the last 6 months. That doesn't give the Fed a justification to start cutting rates.
Steve, do you agree with Stuart and the team at Bloomberg Economics that the median FOMC participant will still see 75 basis points in cuts this year?
I do. That has been where they've been. And when you hear what some of the Fed Bank presidents have said, there's growing concern about the specter of recession and not sticking the soft landing. I agree with Stuart that they are going to come in with median inflation at 2.4 or 2.5%. That's not a big difference. But I don't think that they're going to change the median projection calling, for three cuts sometime in 2024.
So nothing's changed from the end of the last dot plot. Is that what's happened, Stuart? I mean, it's right, because that's what it was.
But I think a lot of the data's changed.
Well, has it though?
That's right. So it's interesting how it nets out, right? Because with inflation running as hot as it has so far to start the year, you would think so much has happened during the intermeeting period. But if we look at some of our growth surprise indices, and we keep track of something like 68, 69, 70 different growth indices and economic activity indices, about 40 of them, 40 out of the 68 or so, surprised to the downside, right? So the Fed is keeping track of everything on its own dashboard as well.
Right.
And so, yes, we've seen hot inflation, but we've also seen growth balancing the other side.
I mean, how important, not every one of those economic indicators is created equal, though. I mean,
sure.
Inflation and the jobs numbers, those are pretty important ones, Stuart.
That's right. Yeah. So absolutely, within the Fed's balance of risk, the two things that are on either side of the seesaw are inflation and full employment. Now, yes, we've seen hot NFP on the other side of the seesaw, but we've also seen a weak household survey for the past 2 months.
Stephen Stuart, I want to get your both thoughts on this. The economic data points, since we're talking about that, I mean, Are they showing that it's getting easier for the Fed to navigate and manage policy without tipping the U.S. economy into recession, or is it getting trickier? And Stuart, let me start with you first. Like, is it the data points giving the Fed more runway to kind of manage things, making it easier for them in terms of not tipping the, and then so not tipping the economy into recession, or is it getting harder?
I think that it, overall, I think that the data point to the Fed having more of a runway, allowing the data all allow the Fed to keep its foot on the brake for a little bit longer.
Yeah.
Growth has been relatively resilient, despite the fact that a lot of the indicators underneath the surface have been surprising to the downside. Of course, the Fed is trying to skate to where the puck is going.
Right.
And so we're going to expect the Fed, we all should be expecting the Fed to start cutting before it hits the 2% inflation target and before we were to drive off that cliff, so to speak.
Hey, do you want to bring a headline to everyone's attention? This crossing the Bloomberg terminal just moments ago, the Supreme Court allows Texas deportation law in a loss for President Biden.
All right, we'll keep an eye on that, give you some more context on that in just a moment. Having said that, actually, we're getting a little bit more context, so let's go through it. The U.S. Supreme Court letting Texas to start arresting and deporting people who enter the country illegally, refusing to block a new law that the Biden administration says will be an unprecedented intrusion on federal power to set immigration policy.
Yeah, over three dissents, the justices rejected the administration's request to keep the Texas law on hold while a legal fight goes forward at a lower court. As is customary with emergency orders, the court as a whole gave no explanation.
And I should point out the rebuff, definitely a blow to President Biden's administration on an issue that has defined, really, up to this point, the 2024 presidential election campaign. Let's go to Steve. Steve, let me put that question to you that Stuart just talked about. Do you think the economic points show that it's getting easier for the Fed to navigate and manage policy without tipping the U.S. economy ultimately into recession, or is it getting trickier?
I believe it's getting trickier, and I believe that the Fed is becoming increasingly nervous about how sensitive things can be. You know, the thing about unemployment is while none of these data are linear, when the unemployment rate starts going up, it tends to continue to move in that direction for a period of time. And the Fed certainly doesn't want to see unemployment above 4%, and we're basically there now with the last data. As Stuart does point out, there is increasing weakness in the economy, although some of the metrics still look pretty good. The other thing is the inflation data have just been peculiar.
Right.
You know, when we look at the January PCE inflation core where owner equivalent rent what was up way out of line with what new leases have been. Portfolio management fees also contributed that. And then you look at February and we see used vehicle prices up, which is inconsistent with associated data. And I think the Fed is trying to figure that out, but I just think they're having a harder time to know which way to go.
All right, we got to leave it on that note. Dr. Steve Skanke, Chief Economic Advisor of at Keel Point, Bloomberg Economics, U.S. Economist Stuart Paul right here in our studio.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Listen live each weekday starting at 2 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Well, the Biden administration is preparing to roll out the toughest ever limits on pollution from the nation's cars and light trucks after making changes likely to mollify some automakers.
All right. So, Tim, emission limits set to be finalized by the Environmental Protection Agency within days would propel electric vehicle sales well beyond current levels. The EPA has projected that to meet proposed mandates, electric models would need to make up roughly 2/3 of car and light truck sales in 2013. Folks, that's up from less than a tenth last year.
All right, so that's the consumer side, mm-hmm. Carol. On the consumer side, EV Reality is a EV infrastructure development platform company. Simply put, EV Realty builds EV charging hubs for delivery, logistics, and services fleet customers.
Right, so the commercial side, right?
Right.
Commercial and consumer. EV Realty CEO Patrick Sullivan joining us for Bloomberg Plugged In, our weekly look at the world of electric vehicles, joining us from San Francisco. We'll get there. It's one of those days. It's a Tuesday. Patrick, good to have you here with us. Tell us, first of all, give us a little perspective about your company and what you guys are doing, the specific project projects that you've already completed, size, scale, who they are, and who is making use of them.
Sure. Carol, Tim, it's nice to be here. So you captured it well. EB Realty develops, deploys, and owns high-powered EV charging hubs, and these are specifically for commercial fleets. So think of anything from your local delivery van to a truck that takes containers from the port. And our approach in thinking about this, which really, I think, dovetails well with the Biden administration's announcement around the clean freight corridors, is we start with the grid. When you think about our power system, it was never designed to fuel trucks or for that matter, cars. And while it's the only 24/7 sort of instantaneous matching marketplace in the world, matching supply and demand instantaneously, it was never designed to fuel these vehicles. So that's really where we start. When you think about 30 million, 40 million vehicles on the road over the next 15, 20 years, finding those locations today that have a lot of power, where you can bring the infrastructure forward sooner and allow that infrastructure to serve commercial fleets, especially some of the large fleets that produce so much of the emissions from the transportation sector. That's really what we're all about.
Patrick, is there a way...
And to your question...
I just want to jump in real quick. Is there a way that you're potentially closing off some business by focusing exclusively on commercial and fleet?
I don't think so. And in fact, I think we're really purposeful about thinking about the fleet sector for a few reasons, and in particular, fleets that return to a home base, whether it's to a warehouse, the parking lot where the vehicles are stored overnight. When you think about planning for large amounts of electrical infrastructure, knowing how the vehicles, how your customers use the trucks or the cars for whatever they're doing, delivering a good, delivering a service, there's more certainty around routes, around planning, around schedules. Think of that as compared to building out a national light-duty passenger vehicle infrastructure where you're, in some degrees, guessing or anticipating uncertain demand. So that's one reason. And then the second I touched on is when you think about the emissions from the transportation sector nationally, it's now larger, obviously, than emissions from the power sector. And that's been due to a lot of really good work over the last 15 years. But within that roughly 29% of emissions coming from transportation, about 25% of it comes from medium and heavy duty trucks. Right. And so you really, and by the way, those are only about 5% of the vehicles on the road. Mm. So you can really target a significant emissions reduction with a relatively small number of vehicles. And again, those vehicles generally follow predictable routes and paths.
Patrick, how much more, though, needs to be built out? And help me understand, because on the consumer side, we've talked a lot about, while there's still growth in the uptick, if you will, of EVs, we've seen a lot of slowdown, right? And that consumers aren't mm-hmm. jumping in so much. What about on the commercial side? How is the growth? Is it the uptick continuing? How does it compare to the last 6 to 12 months? Give us a little perspective, and just got about a minute and a half left here.
Sure, Carol. So the reality is right now today, there's, I don't know, 10 or 15,000 electric medium and heavy duty trucks on the road in the United States. That said, when you think about the plans that the administration has, that states like California, and I think at this point, 11 other states have adopted California's plans. Just in California alone, you're looking at over 500,000 medium and heavy duty trucks on the road by 2035. When you think about the amount of charging and then the amount of power that needs to be pulled from the grid, right, you're talking about 260,000 chargers that need to be installed. You're talking about 25 gigawatts of new power for right. A system that was never designed for that.
Well, and forgive me, we've only got about 25 seconds left here. I get it that there's a lot to be built out. Is it slowing down, though, the demand for it? I'm just trying to get a feel on the commercial demand. Just quickly.
No, and in fact, I think the National Freight Corridor strategy is actually really catalytic to focusing that demand, to finding those locations, these hubs in major cities near ports where you have such a significant volume. If anything, I think you're starting to really see that use case, which the technology and the market and the policies are now well aligned, is really gaining traction amongst commercial fleet operators.
All right. Patrick, really love spending some time with you. Do come back soon, because we'd love to kind of dig a little bit deeper, if we may, in the future. Patrick Sullivan, Chief Executive Officer at EV Realty, joining us from San Francisco, Tim.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
Yeah, how about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
You drive, so you crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
What is the Drive to the Close? Less than 20 minutes to go until the close of trading. And after that, we do, of course, get to Fed Wednesday, as Charlie said. No question, Carol, that the mega caps have gotten a lot of focus lately. After all, NVIDIA was up nearly 240% just last year. It's up around 80% so far this year. Mm. Our next guest, though, argues it's time to think beyond those mega caps.
All right, so let's get to it. Time for our Drive to the Close guest. With us is Jitanya Kanhari, Deputy CIO of the Solutions and Multi-Asset Group over at Morgan Stanley Investment Management, joining us right here in New York City. Jitanya, nice to have you here with Tim and myself. Talk to us a little bit about your thinking of where the gains are going forward. Do you like the tech mega cap names or the big mega caps, but do you also like other areas of the market?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's time to be a little discerning, and markets are also doing the same for you. If you look at the year-to-date moves, it's a couple of the Mega 7 outperforming. Not all are outperforming now. And just like any past tech innovation and revolution that's happened in the past, I think the gains will start disseminating to other sectors. So from the enablers, which are the cloud and the semis companies, to adopters that are companies that will deploy AI and enhance their offerings and services and enhance their earnings and productivity. And we see opportunities in the cybersecurity space. You know, AI means a lot of data. Data proliferation means security of that data. So that's like the second derivative way of playing it, along with sectors like healthcare and even industrials.
I want to jump in because you also like the energy space. We just came off a great interview with our own Alex Steele, who was talking with Jeff Curry over at Carlyle Group. He's their chief strategy officer when it comes to energy pathways. So looking at the energy space holistically and kind of where there are opportunities, where do you see are the best opportunities when it comes to the energy space specifically?
Yeah, so I do think oil is underinvested, underappreciated, and undervalued, right? When you look at oil, even despite EVs becoming 12 to 13% of the global fleet from less than a percent a decade ago, oil consumption is at an all-time high. So demand has been keeping up.
So much for the energy transition. Is that just because there's more of us out there using it, or is it just demand? Like what? Like what? Are, you know, how do you think about then the energy transition?
I think energy transitions are marathons, not sprints. They take a long time. So even historically, when we move from steam to electricity and gas to electricity, those transitions took anywhere between 60 and 90 years. So this time's going to be not different. Solar, wind are still sub 10% of the energy mix. They will continue to dominate, increase presence. But by the time that diffusion to dominance takes place, it can be decades. So in the interim, I do think that given the underinvestment in oil, if you see oil capex has been cut by half since 2015. So you have a demand side that is keeping up, you have a supply that is constrained, and you have an energy transition that, and I think the market's will begin to realize that that is going to take a long time, which makes these assets very compelling from an investment standpoint.
Yeah, I mean, look no further than the sort of the 180 that Hertz has done, Carol.
No, great point.
With its transition.
Look at what it's done to that company.
EVs, exactly. And look at the Detroit automakers too. I'm really interested in, you talked about some of the tech companies that are using AI. You talked about energy. What about industrials? Where do you see opportunities in industrials?
I do find industrials a very interesting group. It's a very diversified group within the, sector classifications, the typical classifications. But I think there are several tailwinds. We have the green capex, we have defense capex, we have substitution capex because of supply chain diversion. AI and data centers use a lot of energy, a lot of industrial capacity. So I think there are a lot of drivers for industrials, like related to AI, the electrification, etc. All of these are, sub-segments within the industrial space. It has been ignored, because tech has been the name of the game last many years. Of course, there's beginning, to be signs of, some value accretion that's happening in that sector. But I think that continues.
Well, Tanya, one thing, and we've just got about 45 seconds to go. All right. So I don't know, you're at a kid's birthday party or a family cocktail party or something over the weekend. Someone says, so how do you think about NVIDIA? Like, how do you... I don't know. What's the constructive conversation you have with individuals, investors around a name like NVIDIA?
I think NVIDIA clearly could be one of the companies that dominates in the top 10 market cap companies by the end of this decade, just like every decade has different leaders.
Yeah.
And, given the scale, size, and, the footprint of this company, it could very well be there. Nothing goes up in a straight line.
Right.
You could have, drawdowns. But I do think that, outside of the Mega 7, the top 10 will look very dramatically different from today. And some of them may be.
No, that's great perspective. And those kids' birthday parties, I don't mean the kids are asking. It's like the parents are all there.
Depends on where the birthday party is. Maybe some of these Silicon Valley birthday parties, they're talking about Hopper and Blackwell.
Kids are savvy.
Hey, what do you think of that new NVIDIA chip?
Oh, my God. Crazy. Great conversation. Jitanya, thank you. Jitanya Khandri joining us, Deputy CIO of the Solutions and Multi-Asset Group over at Morgan Stanley. Khandri, joining us right here on Bloomberg Business Week.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live weekday afternoons from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.